Campus FM presents Treasures from Malta. This episode was originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series, produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. Hello and welcome to season 4 of the Treasures from Malta podcast, a podcast series produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. I am Francesca Balzan, an artist and art historian who goes back a long way with Patrimonio. In this podcast, I meet even more of Malta's living treasures. I meet artists, collectors and historians with some Malta connection, and we have conversations about their life in art. My guest today is one of the world's foremost tenors. He has performed in numerous operatic roles, solo performances and concerts to great acclaim, and has scooped up several major international awards. All this since his early operatic debut at 19 years of age at the Astra Theatre in Gozo. He is a recording artist with one of the top recording labels and has been nominated for the Grammy Awards. Much sought after, his life is a whirlwind of appearances on the major stages of the world. From the Met in New York to the Royal Opera House in Covent Garden, he's constantly lauded, and his golden voice is compared to history's greats. He is in fact considered the successor to Pavarotti. Gregarious and outgoing, his social media accounts chart his travels and his performances, but also his personal life and his island home of Malta, which remains his base. He is known worldwide as the Maltese tenor, and his connections with our country include representing Malta as its first ever cultural ambassador, as well as philanthropic activities to open the world's doors to our young musicians. Joseph Kaleja, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me. I'm not sure I deserve all of that, but I thank you.
Come now, all this modesty. First off, where are you speaking to us from?
I'm in Paris right now. I'm exactly in the middle of my Carmen performances at the Opera Bastille. So I have been away from Malta for roughly a month already, with another month roughly to go.
Joseph, I wonder, were you very musical as a child? I mean, I imagine you singing on the school bus and singing in the shower. Was that the case?
It was the case. It was a case of the voice chose me. And I don't mean this in a hyperbolic statement, but it's the truth. From a very young age, I used to sing the opening music of cartoons. I was in a church choir. Then I had the luck to be in De La Salle College. We had, you know, Daniel Bohajar that loved singing. He was our PE teacher, but also music teacher. He loved singing. He used to play the guitar. And the first notes I ever sang was actually probably with him. You know, then the music in the church choir, and as I was getting older, I got into rock and heavy metal, and I was in a rock band. We used to desecrate the chapel in De La Salle before they realized what music were.
Oh, dear.
And they threw us out. And then at the age of roughly 13, I discovered opera through the movie The Great Peruzzo of Mario Lanza. And when I heard him sing, I imitated him immediately, of course, with a very young, rough voice, but it was there. And everybody around me was like, oh, you can do that too. And yeah, my voice also got me into trouble in the bus. I used to be given punishments for shouting, but I wouldn't be shouting. I would be just talking normally, but it was loud. And then, of course, at the age of 15, I met my teacher and mentor, Paul Aschak, much missed. He was instrumental in reigning in my exuberance and my small village attitude, because in Malta, of course, at the time, this is before internet, you know, we were very insular in many aspects, and he reined me in. It was, you know, I mean, sometimes he used to end up punching me on the shoulder, because he was an Aquarian like me. His birthday would have been on 28th of January, minus 22nd of January, and we were very similar in character, which, of course, when you have similar characters, you know, you fight more. But I loved him. We all loved him, like a grandfather.
What happened after that? Did he guide you to study further abroad? And how did you pursue your studies?
Well, technically, I was so lucky. The only teacher in Malta who would really prepare me for an international career lived at my... He ended up almost, so to speak, living at my house, at my parents' house, because we adopted him and he adopted us. We loved him. It was beyond student teacher. He He guided me. I took lessons with other singers much later, because he would have had a heart attack had he known that I went to somebody else. He was very jealous of me as his student, but I owe him a lot.
So what happened after? Did you go straight to the stage after he taught you all he could?
I don't think he ever taught me all he could. The voice is such a complicated, it's the most difficult instrument to learn. It really is, because it's inside of you. So it's dictated by reflux, acid reflux, mood, sleep, humidity, sickness, so many things that is living thing there, made of mucous membranes, that the technique to master it is ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
Today, before I spoke to you, before I went for a walk, I was vocalizing and singing through the difficult passages of Carmen with my girlfriend, who's also a singer. And, you know, is the sound good? Is the sound better? And you know, you have to be honest about these things and work on them. It's an ongoing process. So you never really stop studying. At the age of 15, I remember, I've got to know this later, but apparently when he heard me, he called my dad the same evening. He told him, if your son studies, I'll make him into one of the best opera singers in the world. That was the first time he heard me. And my dad didn't tell me, because he told me not to tell me, but obviously not, it doesn't go to my head. Although I'm not really a person prone to that. I always take success very, very, with a big pinch of salt. And I explain that later why. But then they told me that, you know, if I put my heart into it, my heart was definitely into it. And, remember, there was no one at the time, save for Miriam Gauci, that had a career. Then you had to go back. Then you had to go back, I don't know, almost half a century. There was Paul Asher, Boris Tekirkov, Giuseppe Satariano. If I'm leaving some names out, but I don't think so. And these were the ones that really had, you know, done something abroad. Mm-hmm. There are those who said they did do stuff abroad. In fact, they didn't, which I always find extraordinary when people make these kind of claims, but I'm not going to get into that. And then I did, at the age of 19, I did the Belvedere Hans Gabor competition in Vienna. There were 3,100 participants from all over the world. And I was one of the 7 prize winners and to this date, the youngest ever that won a prize in this after 25, 26 odd years now. And that gave us the seal of approval that Paul was right, that there was something special that people found in my voice. And then after that, I had my Astra debut. I think Astra debut was before, a month before. And then in 3 months only, the Nationale Rijks Opera is in the Netherlands, in Enschede. They gave me a big role, a leading role, Lester in Donizetti's Maria Stuarda. And after that, I never looked back.
You took off. At that stage, the critics had spotted you as well. You got reviewed well, so that would have started it off.
Yeah, immediately they started. I didn't call myself the Maltese tenor. They used to call me two names at the time. Three, either my name or either the Maltese Falcon or the Maltese tenor. And I chose to adopt the Maltese tenor because the Maltese Falcon, you know, I'm 6 foot two and a half, 125, 28 kilos, and not much of a falcon. So I chose the Maltese tenor. But it was the...
At least they avoided the Maltese dog, which is the most famous Maltese that you'll find on the internet.
That's so far I was never called. I was called on a horrible name, but not yet Maltese dog. So the German and the English and the French press, they started referring me as the Maltese tenor, and the term stuck.
It stuck, and it ended up the name of one of your albums, in fact, with Decca.
Yes, as well.
Okay. Did you have a consciousness of how special your voice was at a young age?
Yes, I had it, but that consciousness was coupled with an incredible insecurity. We all have insecurities, and till this day, I get voices in my head. Before a performance, you're a fake, you're a fraud, you're overrated, and
imposter syndrome.
And those of us who are honest, we acknowledge those voices. We know they're bullshit. Because of course, you know, you can't fool people for a quarter of a century, but you get it all the time. And when you're established, people only wait for your demise, for your decline, because we're with the curse or a blessing, because it can be both sides, of you're only as good as your last performance.
Absolutely. Joseph, I asked you to pick some pieces of music, and now we're going to listen to you singing Charmaine from the album The Magic of Mantovani, which was the latest album of yours that was released in 2020 by Decap. Why did you choose this piece in particular?
This recording, The Magic of Mantovani, is almost a miracle of music making, because somehow this music, which was recorded even before my mother was born, Mantovani's interpretation of this music and my interpretation of this music coincided that when I sang on the original music that he recorded, this is not a new interpretation, this is the actual analog recordings which Decca transferred to stereo, digital recordings that I just then sang over. And the result is so natural is that it's uncanny. And of course, then there is the Maltese connection that, Mantovani's had his beginnings at the Hotel Metropole, which is nowadays the Corinthia Hotel, London.
I wonder why you keep me waiting, Charmaine, Charmaine.
Been repeatedly compared to Pavarotti, Giglio, Caruso. What does that do to you as an artist? I mean, is it merely a compliment and sort of an acknowledgement that you've reached the highest possible bar? Or does it kind of act as a challenge to distinguish yourself, maybe kind of even outdo your predecessors?
Outdoing any of these names, Caruso, Giglio, Pavarotti, is impossible. These people were... Even matching them, I think, would be equally impossible because they came from a different era. Even Luciano, even though Luciano is, of course, much more modern. They came from a time when going to New York took 3 weeks. You could rest your voice. You weren't exposed to the dry air of the flight, to jet lag, obviously, because you're crossing the time zones very slowly. So you arrived there fresh. They had challenges in the sense that there wasn't the medicine we have today.
Absolutely.
But they had the best medicine, which was real rest, real time to take time.
Mm-hmm.
And as well, they didn't have one thing, the pressure of the online thing. Mm-hmm. My friend and UK Trust co-founder, James Drake.
Mm-hmm. Who we'll talk about later.
Yeah. Of the Drake Galea Trust. He bought 500 to 600 letters of Caruso himself, mm-hmm. with the original in the envelope with the flowers. And when Caruso was still in his prime, he used to write in English to his wife Dorothy. And his handwriting, his calligraphy was beautiful. And I've read, White Gloves. I've read the letters he wrote. And he used to say to me, "Oh, today I cracked 4 times." In the opera, but the public didn't audience in a month. They still, but if you do that today, it's going to be on YouTube and you're going to be, "Oh, he's finished." So the human voice, and especially in opera, there is so much of an unfair pressure to be completely 100% all the time. No one was 100% all the time. And the greats of the past had possibly even more bad nights than what we have today. And even when considering that they, had much more liberty with the score. They used to cut operas, used to lower them down, much more. But they were great. They were so great that sometimes they sang two operas in the same day. Because nowadays I hear the story, for example, today modern singers are too much financially oriented. Well, Caruso, and I saw the letters and the contracts and the checks when he did this, used to sing two operas a day on tour in South America. He used to sing at 11 p.m. Elisir d'Amore and the evening sing Aida to make...
Amazing.
To satisfy the public and make, of course, as much money as possible. So
you wouldn't be allowed to do it today.
Well, today, I'm sure they would cut the score a lot because it's almost physically impossible to do both, but it used to happen. And, So how do I take these claims? I mean, of course, it provokes a little bit of satisfaction or being pleased, but then you realize how outrageous the claim is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how do you match Luciano? I mean, Luciano, I don't even know how to explain. I do the driving test, go for a long car ride, mm-hmm. and you have a compilation of the greatest tenors on record from even before Caruso till the modern day, you know. And when his voice comes, there's something, which is why he was the greatest opera talent to ever live. I mean, the most famous, that is. He had this calmness. It just, you know, of course Corelli is great, Caruso's amazing, Gigli, mm-hmm. Domingo, but when Luciano's voice came, you just feel this, like it is not singing, like it's talking.
Yes.
Like it's so easy. Uh-huh. There's something that engulfs you, wraps you, and mm-hmm. and you relax, like every, it's a relax, it just try it. There's something about his sound that is just outwardly, that's there's something that it's so, it resonates. I don't know. I'm probably going to say something very stupid. It's like a hypoallergenic voice. It agrees with everyone. I can't, you know, it's a bad analogy, but that's, so when I hear these comparisons, they, of course, you know, I'm happy. I mean, it's better mm-hmm. than being compared to Bassi. But of course, I take them with an enormous pinch of salt.
Yes. Yes. I mean, you say this and you have great respect for the greats, of course, and yet you are mentioned in the same breath as them. For example, the Sunday Times of London, and I quote, "Any doubts about the most winning lyric Italian tenor since Pavarotti tackling this heavy Verdi repertoire are largely dispelled by the vitality of his sunny sound and the clarity of his diction." And they're comparing you there to Pavarotti. They're talking about you. So it is quite remarkable.
But I tell you why. So although the timbres are different, like every timbre of the voice is like a fingerprint. There's mm-hmm. no two that are the same.
It's unique.
But let's say the voice of Björling, Pavarotti and my voice, I'm not saying that I'm as great as them. I'm just saying that if you take that grouping,
you're comparing.
We are the same type of voice, a mm-hmm. lyric to a lyrical spinto. Bright with a fuzz vibrato, with an easy top, and that's, so we belong in the same category. It's like a BMW X5, Range Rover Sport, and Audi Q7. They belong, you know, when you go to car rentals, mm-hmm. they belong to the SUVs. Yeah. It doesn't mean that they're all the same. It doesn't mean that they're equal. Mm-hmm. It's just that they're the same category. So I understand those comparisons, and yeah, when I have a really great night, because I, you know, not every night at the opera is great for a singer, even though the audience will not notice most of the time. But I sometimes approached that level of singing.
Okay, that's the most modest way of saying.
No, it's. I'm just saying the truth, honestly. I mean, okay.
No, fantastic. It's a good attitude.
The problem about these reviews, if you take the good ones seriously, you also have to take the bad ones seriously. So I'd rather take all of them with a pinch of salt.
In fact, I really want to talk to you about criticism. Did you really listen to the art critics, especially when you were moving up the ladder in your early days? And how greatly did they shape your role? I mean, were you really influenced by them, or do you have to keep a bit of distance from them because they can crush you?
Well, it depends. It depends. Let me give you, this is true, okay? I've been angry at the rare bad review when the reviewer mm-hmm. is obviously has an agenda, especially
unfair.
Somebody else or unfair. Yeah. I've been angry, mm-hmm. but I've been also angry. When I sung a really not good, not bad, but not good performance. And the reviewer gave me a great review. I said, "What the hell?" You know, wouldn't know him, of course. I, you know, we don't fraternize with critics in normal circumstances.
Lazy, not discerning, that you felt treated.
So when I know that a reviewer is in good faith, right? Because there's criticism that it's in good faith, and there's criticism that's in bad faith. Which, in better terms, honest criticism and false criticism. If it's honest, even if scathing, I listen to it, of course. Artists that tell you they don't read reviews are lying. They all read the reviews. And the ones that they say that they don't, they're the first one to read them. So as I was growing up, because of Paul and because of, you know, I wanted to know what people, you know, used to go and buy the newspaper before they became easy on internet or buy the subscription to see what they wrote. Today, I don't really like religiously search for them, but, you know, I Google my name sometimes and see what's up, see what people are saying.
Of course.
A bad review, if does it hurt me? It depends. If the performance wasn't great, no, it doesn't. Oh, he's, great. Someone that still has ears. So, yeah, I've usually my percentage of good reviews is really high, but occasionally you always find somebody that doesn't like you, and that's okay. You know, it's like wine, like anything in life. You know, you can't be liked by everyone. Please everyone. That's impossible. So did it shape my career? No. Did it open my eyes? I mean, I'll give you one example. Even though it's not vocal. Once David Meller, who today is huge, he's like family. He's family. He's not like his family for me. The UK ex-minister, you know, he wrote about me, that I sounded like Yusuf Yoling. It's such a pity though that he cannot stop getting fat. And it was years ago. It was in a really particularly bad period of my life, with you know, going through some personal stuff. Yeah. And I ballooned. And when this came out in the mail on Sunday, by coincidence, we were sitting opposite each other at an ambassador's home in London. I forgot where, but it was an ambassador's home. And he was like, "Oh, my dear boy, I have to apologize because I've been maybe too high." I said, no, he said the truth. And in 2 months, I went down 25 kilos, I remember, after that. So it opened and, you know.
It actually did something
and
to you.
And because I was always, you know, I'm a big man. I will always be a big man, even when I have no tummy, because my shoulders are huge. My muscle mass is considerable. So I'll always be a big man. But then, you know, then there's the other line, which you can become, you know, close to morbidly obese. But because I'm very strong, I still play basketball, still swam, still dive. My weight, although it fluctuated enormously throughout the years, it never stopped me. Now I go to the gym, you know, under normal circumstances, 4 or 5 times a week. And that's not including the walks and the power walks and stuff like that. So, and the act of rehearsing and singing is in itself a very physically demanding exercise job. So, you know, sometimes there is something that somebody tells you that opens your eyes. Sometimes I've learned more from people when we used to have opera forums. Now, unfortunately, they pretty much died down. I used to learn so much from normal people writing stuff. Yeah, you have to be thick-skinned, but I am thick-skinned. I became thick-skinned.
Joseph, let's give your voice a break now, and we'll listen to you sing E luce van le stelle from Tosca. This is a recording from the Maltese Tenor album by Decca.
Sfiorava l'arena
And we're back. Don't forget to go to our podcast page on www.patrimonio.org to see pictures and links to what we've discussed in each podcast episode. Joseph, we've mentioned the voice and how it can be strained, and I know that with previous singers that we've interviewed on the podcast, they've stressed time and time again how important it is not to strain your voice or to take on roles that you're not ready for yet. Now, you've said that your voice is still developing as well. Are there roles that you still cannot allow yourself to take on?
Plenty. There's things, for example, like Othello. There's a lot of roles that I'm not suited for. And yet, there's a lot of truth in that, aside from taking care of yourself, sleeping, resting, eating good food, maintaining a healthy weight, exercise, that there's certainly singing stuff that you should be singing and not, you know, pushing yourself will increase your longevity. Mm-hmm.
And yet you're taking on new roles. For example, and you have hinted at this as well, in the summer you'll be debuting Wagner's last work, Parsifal, during the Bayreuth Festival. Yes. Now, I read that it promises to be an unusual experience for audiences using VR. You're using virtual reality technologies. So tell me about preparations for this role. It's new for you. You've had to study German for it. And what else? How have you been preparing?
I've been studying German for now more than 3 years. I have pretty much 2 months time with just a repetiteur to go through the role again and again and again. And hopefully by the time that I will be on stage, I will be well prepared, which I will be, which I have to be, because it's my debut as well.
Now, I've seen some recordings where you'll sing rock and roll or pop or other genres for fun. And I know you've sung Maltese traditional carols. In fact, Decca published one of these on their Christmas Instagram account. And Queen, I've seen you sing Queen with your daughter, Clara, who's a fantastic singer in her own right. Now, can you ever see yourself crossing genres and entirely and singing some other type completely?
I could. I'm not sure that I should.
Would you like to?
No. I don't know. I don't know what the future might bring. But what I've learned today is that, you know, never say never. But I don't intend to. There are no plans for me to do so. But certainly, you know, it's something that, who knows? You know, maybe there will be one collaboration, one pop song collaboration. You know, you never
Indeed.
Know.
Indeed. And what's your favorite role to sing? And what's your favorite opera character to inhabit? And why?
Favorite role? It's hard. It depends on my mood. Let's say that I love performing Tosca. I love performing Don Jose that I'm doing now. I love Tales of Hoffman it depends. I have many favorite roles. I can't just choose one. If I had to choose the most complete opera, I'm going to give you Verdi's Requiem, even though it's not opera per se. It's written in the most operatic way possible. It's in my opinion, his biggest masterpiece, even more than Falstaff and Othello, in my opinion. His Requiem is just one beautiful melody, outwardly melodies. I mean, let's take the Dies Irae, for example. I mean, when people tell me classical music is boring, I point them to that. I said, okay, is this boring? I'm probably going to be lampooned or killed for this comment, but it is the most heavy metal of the music that I've ever heard. I mean, it's the most... You know, it's just there's something outwardly, you know, gets your hair raising. You know, hair-raising music, and it goes from that kind of intensity, then it goes to Ostias Neofertor, and it goes like, Ostias, and you have these beautiful soft moments, and you have, you know,
you know, Joseph, you can go on. There's plenty of time to hear you sing. Now, you're a recording artist for Decca, and you're on an exclusive contract. So presumably they'll have my head if I allow you to sing or if I ask you to sing on the podcast. Shall we test them? Shall we try them? Shall we make them angry?
Better not. I've just done anyway.
So. Of course, Decca Classics is one of the major recording labels worldwide, and you were signed up in 2003. I mean, they have other major stars on their roster, people like René Fleming and Cecilia Bartoli. And let's not forget that Luciano Pavarotti was signed up exclusively to them. Now, how many records have you recorded since with them?
Just recitals, I think, just solo records. I think this, I'm not sure if it's the seventh one. I think it's the seventh one that I've done.
The last one was the 2020, The Magic of Mantovani album.
Mantovani, but no, the last one I just did with the Malta Philharmonic last year now, because it's 2022. I mean, that is, it was my dream to bring the Maltese Orchestra, the Maltese Philharmonic on the label, and finally it transpired. I mean, the love for my country is not affected. It's not fake. It's genuine.
Yes.
And as well with what we're doing with the BOV Joseph Kalea Foundation.
Indeed.
I mean, that is just doing good for the sake of doing good. And I'm the Maltese culture ambassador. I've declined all kind of remuneration, but I kept the title. And, you know, I mean, pushing my country and, you know, representing my country is for me very, genuinely very important. It's not something which is fake, as I said before, or affected. So bringing forward the Malta Philharmonic on one of the best labels, classical labels in the world, is a dream come true. And it's materializing now in just a few weeks with the release of this sacred music album. I can't say the name because we haven't yet decided 100%. But,
I see. Okay.
It's a beautiful collaboration with Maestro Sergei Sambatyan, the Maltese Philharmonic, and of course myself.
You've teased us with a few hints. Back in April, you hashtagged sacred music when you said you were recording with Decca and the Malta Philharmonic. But otherwise, we don't know exactly what music you're going to be singing to, and we don't know exactly what the contents are. But we'll be watching out. So this happens in the spring, very, very soon.
This happens just before Easter.
So we touched upon your role as Malta's first ever, actually, cultural ambassador. You were appointed in 2012. What is a cultural ambassador's brief? How can you push forward the name of Malta?
I have lost count, for example, of the, even before Lawrence Gonzi made me, ex-Prime Minister Lawrence Gonzi in 2012. I lost count the number of world-class publications, magazines, TV stations, radio stations that came to Malta and featured me or featured me talking about Malta. For example, Deutsche Welle, who's the most watched channel, at least it was at the time. I think that they had billions of viewers, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
We had done a five episode program about Malta that I've presented myself. At the time, I cringe when I see it today, but it's actually good because I'm so terrible that I'm funny and it works in the program. Today, I would have done a better job, but it was honest. And, you know, I mean, CNN, ORF, Classic FM, BBC, Sky Arts, Sky News, these channels have come to Malta to feature me, and indirectly, of course, and directly sometimes Malta. Because
mm-hmm.
when I had the choice, even for my photo shoots, I always pushed them to be done in Malta. Lately, I've toured around with Ape Kekeling, who's a German comedian. He came to do various programs about Malta, and one of them was with me. And because of my name, the Maltese tenor, and because of my ties, I even, in the background, I don't know, from movie productions, major artists doing their videos of Malta, like Andrea Bocelli, like his son, Matteo mm-hmm. Bocelli, you know, these all came majorly because, you know, I hammered in them, in their managers, in Veronica Bertis, for example, Andrea's wife, you know, the beauty of Malta. And, yeah, I mean, as I said, I'm called as the Maltese tenor. Every time I mention, every time there's anything in any newspaper, mm-hmm. you know, the name of Malta's there. The brief is almost unlimited. At the moment, for example, I'm in talks with a movie producer that wants to come and film in Malta. This came through another ambassador of Malta, James Vallabardone, who's an incredible author. He issued a trilogy of books, The Sheriff's Catch. I'm on the second book right now. An incredibly talented man.
Is it an open-ended term, actually?
So far as they want me, yeah, it's an open-ended term. Yeah.
Now, you've mentioned a bit of acting as well. And in 2014, a film was released in which you acted. So you've done a bit of Hollywood acting. Not the first Joseph Kalea to do so, incidentally. You do, of course, yeah. know about the famous yeah, Joseph Kalea, who made quite a name for himself in the mid-20th century in Hollywood.
Major artist in his time. Absolutely. Major character actor.
Yeah. Absolutely. So Joseph Kalea seems to be a very lucky name to Hollywood. You played Enrico Caruso in the film The Immigrant. Now, is it something you'd like to do again? Can you see yourself acting as a film actor?
Evolia was more good looking. No, on a serious note, that was a very small role. It was a cameo, 90-second role in the movie. But it came through my friendship with James Gray, again, a movie producer who has done so many great films, majorly with Joaquin Phoenix, like The Color of Money and The Color of the Night, I think, not The Color of Money, and of course The Immigrant and the string of other movies. And there's one other person whom I'm trying to bring to the Maltese shores for a movie. The experience was great. Loved it. I'm a huge movie buff. And for those of you actually who don't know, the Joseph Kalea, I'm not named after him, by the way. I'm named after my grandfather, my paternal grandfather. But Joseph Kalea, who went by the names like Vincent Spurin at some stage as well, he, in the 70s, he was the first choice as the godfather
for
the role of Vito Corleone in the first Godfather movie. But he was too old. And when I did The Immigrant, Francis Ford Coppola had a chat with James Gray. This is James Gray telling me himself, by the way. And he told me, he told him, Francis, I have Joseph Kalea, an opera singer, for a cameo role. And, oh, I'm so jealous. I wanted Pavarotti for Godfather too, but he was too expensive. I always got paid nothing for that. For an immigrant, but they had to give me something very small because of union regulations in the U.S. But I was so proud to just being there and watching Marion Cotillard acting and watching Jeremy Renner, who is also in the movie. The young ones will know Jeremy Renner from Hawkeye in the Avenger movies. It was a nice
good fun. You might not be related but to Joseph Kalea, but I am, actually, through my father. He remembers him.
All the Kaleas in Malta are related somehow. All the Kaleas in Malta somehow are distantly, of course, but you know, it's one of the oldest surnames that came to Malta, I think, around the 1490.
Let's hear another piece in which you are singing O Mostruosa Colpa from the Kalea Verdi album. Why did you pick this piece in particular?
I chose this piece because it might show where the voice is going to head. This is Otello, and I'm playing, of course, I'm singing Otello, and Iago is Vittorio Vitelli. It was recorded a couple of years ago in Valencia with Maestro Ramon Tebar, and I think it's one of the most beautiful tenor baritone duets out there, and I think that Vittorio and myself do it justice.
Let's hear it then.
Ancora
Joseph, you've also received a Grammy nomination for your portrayal of Alfredo in the Royal Opera House's DVD Blu-ray release of La Traviata, and you've co-starred with Renée Fleming and Thomas Hampson. Tell me about the excitement of receiving that news, the Grammy nomination.
It's nice. I have quite a few now. You know, the tally has risen of these awards. It's nice. It's great to have. But I don't know. There's something about my family. We're very tough when it comes to receiving awards and compliments. We don't really dwell on it. It's maybe a bit sad, but we tend to focus more on the negative and on what's wrong rather than, because the good is good and everybody loves the good. Mm-hmm. But the bad, the negative is what you need to work on and fix to improve yourself. So unfortunately, I have a bit of that mindset. These awards, I love them. I love receiving them. Mm-hmm. I love being honorary member of the Royal Academy of Music. I love being a Cavaliere of the Italian Republic. You know, it's great, but I don't give them much thought.
This is the hallmark of the perfectionist. You always concentrate on the negative because you think you can somehow improve.
Maybe. I don't know, but I mean, it's the same with gifts. I love giving gifts. I don't know how to receive gifts. Mm-hmm. It's a fact that when somebody overwhelms me with a beautiful gift, I'm usually speechless. I thank them, of course, but...
So let's talk about giving. You've set up two foundations. One of them, we've already had the occasion to mention in connection with the BOV Joseph Callea Children's Choir with an earlier guest on the podcast with soprano and a friend of yours, Gillian Zamit, who directs the choir. And we discussed the children's choir at length. You set up the BOV Joseph Callea Foundation, and this, of course, has philanthropic ends, and it provides opportunities for Malta-based music scholars. You also set up the Drake Callea Trust, which we mentioned earlier, and this provides scholarships internationally. What motivates this?
Doing good for the sake of doing good, nothing else. Now it's in the millions. It's 1.5 million.
In what sense? In the millions, what is being spent on scholarships and what is being collected?
Yeah, it's 1.5 million in Malta alone. That mostly it's pretty much private money. Our patrons, that without them we're nothing. My board members, that without them I'm nothing. Roderick Chalmers, the chairman. Sabine Cabaudin, Alfred Pisani, who just left the board, but was replaced by another Corinthia stalwart, Alfred Fabri, mm-hmm. Father Michael Ajous, Dr. Alec Lapira, my doctor, mm-hmm. who played a crucial point of reference in my career, saved my voice many times.
In what sense? Does he actually advise you to hold back on certain roles?
Medically, no. Dr. Alec Lapira, apart from his... one of my oldest and trusted friends. He is a beautiful human being and an incredibly talented professional in his field. I would say his blight is that he was born in Malta. Because this guy would be a world-class authority if he would be born in New York or London. I mean, he really is so knowledgeable and he gave me a lot of good advice when I was ill. You know, singers get ill as well. And yeah, but going back, but the foundation is, I don't want to say selfish, because it's anything but selfish, but I didn't want one talent in Malta to go unrecognized just because his or her family wouldn't have the means to help them with the initial stages of their career. And now we're helping around 90 Maltese scholars, some of them on the brink of an international career in their respective field, not just from opera. We help ballet dancers, stage designers, mm-hmm. stage directors, pianists, instrumentalists, jazz guitarists, from all the plethora of the performing arts, visual artists, you know, and, you know, anything that, you know, anyone. And what's beautiful about this foundation is that if you give 1,000 euros, 999 point something goes directly to the cause. I don't say 100%. Because we have a website. That's the only thing.
I see. So admin costs and all that.
I've got that.
There's nothing. It's all voluntary.
I've got that covered. It's all voluntary. And of course, we're registered. We were audited. But it is an incredible labor of love.
Paul Usher would be proud.
He would be very proud.
You know, you've replicated his kindness and passed it on.
He would be very, but again, I have to mention again the board. I mean, we have an incredible dream chairman, Roderick Chalmers. And it doesn't stop at writing checks or transferring money. We give advice, you know, I mean, today, for example.
So mentoring as well.
Mentoring as well. For example, we have one of the artists who are on the brink of international career is Marvic Monreal. Marvick Monreal, she's going places. I don't want to announce things that she's going to be doing in the next few years because that's up to her, but she's going places. She's going to be a major opera star, the first mezzo-soprano opera star Malta has ever had, and she has the right attitude to go with it. She's a delightful human being. Another young talent, Charles Buttigieg, who at the age of 19 was accepted at the Curtis Institute in Philadelphia, that they have less admission rates than Yale and Harvard. 3.1% only get there. And he's the youngest ever, young man from little more than a boy from Ein Silam in Gozo. And we helped, the foundation helped him every step of the way. And, you know, when there's so many similar success stories like this. And, as I said, 1.5 million by multi-standards, that is a huge amount of money that changed 90 lives and, brought culture to around 3,000 children from the more challenging areas in school in Malta by sponsoring cultural programs, et cetera. And, the only motivation is doing good, whether people want to believe it or not. And I urge those who can give, those who can, part with a couple of hundredth or a couple of thousand, that all this money goes to further Malta's name in the performing arts.
Joseph, you've rubbed shoulders with the great and the good. Now, only recently, actually upon her passing, you said that Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was Associate Justice of the Supreme Court and was an incredible legal mind who has left a mark on legal history internationally.
Biggest American icon of the past.
Incredible. 10, 15 years. The notorious RBG. She was a guest at your Meleha home on more than one occasion. We didn't know about this connection. It was only on her passing that you mentioned it and you showed a letter.
Because it was a private.
She was also a great opera fan, so you're connected on that level as well. Has any one of these remarkable people you've met throughout the course of a 26-year-long career, has anyone left a particular impact on you?
From the greats, I would say all of them. Greatness is not measured by deeds alone. Greatness is how these same people behave and how they put themselves out to the world in spite of what they have achieved or in spite of their grandeur. For example, you mentioned Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in my eyes, she was the brain and spirit of a 21-year-old, incredibly smart, intelligent woman, trapped in an old and frail body. And the hunger for life that these people have, you know, when they're pushing 80 or even more than that, you know, they still work out, they still eat what they want, they still drink, they still have discipline. It's incredible. When their body's giving out, that their spirit, till the last mile, till the last meter, they keep on pushing to live the best life and to contribute to society till the last, literally the last breath they're taking. And now, and you know, when you, I met King Charles, now King Charles, on a number of occasions, and he, we had whiskeys together. Mm-hmm. You know, we had a 45-hour conversation, you know, in a private party that I sang for in Buckingham Palace, you know, just for 25 people.
And you were struck by what in your conversations?
I was struck, in his case, also by his incredible humility. The guy has an incredible, wicked sense of humor and the best
British tradition.
You know, I mean, you know, when I was with Snoop Dogg in the White House and he was smoking weed, you can find this on YouTube. They asked him which was the most outrageous place where he smoked weed. And he replied, the White House. I was there with him. I hate smoking weed. I have nothing against smoking weed, by the way, but I don't like the smell. I hate cigarettes. I will smoke when I'm not singing the very occasional cigar. I'm talking less than 12 cigars a year. But I was watching him and I was laughing. I was there with him. You know, I danced with Glenn Close in the White House because I was there for a whole weekend.
How come you were there for the weekend?
It was the Kennedy Center honorees. We're there for a whole weekend in Georgetown and went to the White House I think twice. And, it was Obama, you know, and, when I met Senator John Kerry, you compared him to their TV screen
personalities
and sometimes TV lies. Like Senator Kerry on TV looks like a very boring man, almost like an undertaker somehow. This is why he lost the election. People said this, that he didn't have the, in person, the man is one of the most interesting. I mean, I had dinner with Henry Kissinger 3 times, just the 6 of us, you know, one of them with my cousin who didn't recognize him at the time. But we're not going to go there. But yeah, but there's these, you know, there's these instances. And usually in these instances, when I'm surrounded by these people, I shut up and listen and be the sponge absorbing what these people have to say. When I had Andrea Bocelli over at my house for a 6-hour long dinner, I mean, it was surreal. I've been a fan since I was in my teens. And to then discover Andrea Bocelli, he was there with his family, what not just an extraordinary artist he is, but what a beautiful, beautiful human being he is, all of them, with not a grain of arrogance, which I hate arrogance. So when people ask me, oh, how come you're not arrogant? How come you're not, how come you're humble? I'm not humble. I'm just happy-ish in my skin, because I think that that's our biggest hurdle in life, is to be happy with who we are. Mm-hmm. Many people are unhappy and they make other people unhappy because they project their frustration on others, onto others. So I try not to do that. Even when I'm undergoing incredible stress, incredible worry, I try never to project that worry on others, because others are innocent. There's that. And is the humility that I've learned from most of these people and their intelligence and their, you know, I try to absorb as much as possible.
Joseph, your connection with Malta remains extremely strong. You still keep a house in Malta and you return to it between performances. It is your base. Your immediate family is in Malta. And you've got an annual appointment in summer to headline a concert and perform amongst Maltese singers, and not necessarily in the operatic genre, but also pop music and singers from different disciplines as well. How important is this annual performance for you?
Believe it or not, is the performance I'm most nervous for, because if I don't sing well, I hear about it for a whole year till I sing then better, you know, because you get this. Last year, an example, I was ill. I still sang. So some people could hear that I wasn't 100%. And today, oh, are you better? You know, yeah, it's been 6 months. I am better. I'm fine.
Come on, Joseph. We're all watching out for you. We have ownership.
Absolutely. So there's that. So of course is the one I'm most nervous for, but we have achieved incredible greatness with these concerts. Here I have to mention my other fraternal friend, Anton Attart. You know, we did these concerts. We started with the majority of them with NNG Promotions, and we took them around the world. It has been shown in 3 different continents all around the world, Sky TV, on the PBS in America. We have, you know, in Romania, in Hungary, in Italy, in the UK, in Spain, in Germany. You know, they've been all over. And when I started in 2008 doing concerts, I told them, within a couple of years, we're going to be international. And I said, it's impossible. I said, it's going to happen. And it did. And Sky Arts UK have an email that we boosted their Friday a couple of years ago when they shown the concert from Malta. We boosted their Friday viewership by 100%. I have the email that when, you know, so it's nice to have that kind of reaction. Now we're planning another thing, not from my summer concert, but another thing to launch the album around Easter. So that's going to be that's some news as well. And instead of the summer concert this year, we're planning something around Christmas. But, you know, we have to watch the space, but it's going to be huge. It's going to be huge.
Joseph, you've done all the major opera houses, most of the major roles. The critics love you. You've ticked box after box.
Sometimes.
Are there any further boxes to tick? Any milestones you feel you need to achieve?
I mean, singing at La Scala would be nice. I mean, I was called to sing there a total of 10 times. It didn't happen for an incredible various reasons. That's the only theater in the major theater in the world where I haven't sung it in. I've sung in all of them. Otherwise, continuing developing and sing for another 15 to 20 years. Mm-hmm. I want to do other stuff in life, not just singing. I'm not one of these people that at the age of 80, I'm still gonna try to be croaking on stage, whether good or not croaking, whether
we'll see.
But I hope not. But yeah, because I'm in love with life. You know, I dive, yeah. I fish, I go for walks. I love dogs. I adore my two children. I like eating out. I like great wine. And in Malta, we're so lucky to have Michael Tabone, Vatelier Michael Tabone, that has changed the lives of wine lovers in Malta. And, I love life. And, the problem with opera is that when you're singing at this level, you can't really enjoy life that much because you can't drink, you can't really eat what you want, you can't have a cigar, you can't even talk because you need to save your voice for the next performance. So it gives a lot, it gives you a lot, but it also takes a lot, unfortunately, as well.
And finally, you're clearly an aesthete and you appreciate fine wine, fine food, you love to travel, you love beauty. Now tell me about your love affair with wine.
It all started when I was 19. I met this French, she was like my grandmother, Colette. She passed away, unfortunately, only last year, exactly almost to the date. 22nd February she died, 2022. And she had a house in Belgium, in Lens. And I used to go there and I saw a lot of wine. I said, what is this? I said, oh, I never drink it. My brother is in wine in Burgundy. And I started tasting it. I said, Jesus, it's really great stuff. I don't know what it is, but, and I started buying a few bottles here and there and put them in storage. And then I met, through Maltese conductor Brian Schembri, I met Michael Tabone. I don't know if it was 2005. I'm not sure, something like that. And, we adopted each other. We fell in love platonically, but with him and Pat, and he introduced me to the Bordeaux, to the Saint-Emilion, and I went to Saint-Emilion, and then when I went to Saint-Emilion, the deal was sealed. I was in love. It's a beautiful city, beautiful people, and the most amazing wine in the world.
Joseph, on that happy note, I'm going to close off the podcast. It's been wonderful catching up with you, understanding what goes on in your life in terms of opera, in terms of singing, your appreciation of your voice and your gratitude, the fact that you've been given such a great gift. Please continue to take care of it and we will be watching your career as it progresses even more.
Thank you so much, Francesca. It's been a huge pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Treasures from Malta on Campus FM. This was originally recorded as a podcast and there are pictures and links to all we've discussed on the Fondazione Patrimonio Malti website,